It's Wednesday, the 28th of May. I'm Alec Hogg, and here's your Biz News Briefing. I was inundated with emails yesterday from members of the tribe to say, oh, here's a really good piece of body language on the Oval Office SmackDown. And I've picked up a little piece of that for our tailpiece today. It's from the guy who's known as the body language guy on social media. He's got 775,000 subscribers to his YouTube channel. His name is Jesus Enrique Rosas. And that'll be coming up in the tailpiece today. But we've got lots more news to update you with, starting off with evidence that's emerging that the horrific state pensioner-funded operation Daybreak, you know, where the chickens were eating each other because of just bad management, it's not an isolated exception, apparently. Zirk Ghos, who's spokesman for the Association for Monitoring and Advocacy of Government Pensions, says that enough is enough. He spoke with my colleague, Chris Stain.
Zirk, who should be held accountable ultimately for these bad investments with government employees' pension money?
That's a very, very good question. If you look at the core problem is that both the Government Employee Pension Fund and the Public Investment Corporation are under total political control. I'm not going to go into all the legalities, simply let us summarize it. The Minister of Finance say, where do you put your money? It must approve all the investments made by the Government Employee Pension Fund. The moment you go and you use pension fund money and you use it for political considerations, then it is problematic. If you want to go political consideration down that route, you must use simply tax money. You cannot use the funds of a pension fund. It is simply in principle problematic. So if we look at the vulnerable employees of Daybreak, of all the contractors which stands at risk of going insolvent in itself, who should be accountable? Accountable should be Minister of Finance, the Board of Trustees of the JPF, and the Board of Directors of the Public Investment Corporation. With their approval, they invest in high-risk investments like Daybreak. It thus means they are not acting in the best interest of the fund, but they are acting in the best interest of the ruling political party. They are pursuing high-risk political investments. They are thus not adhering to their fiduciary duties. And their fiduciary duties is very clear. Act in the best interest of the fund. They are not doing it. So the people which should be called to account for the pain and the suffering of the Daybreak employees, Minister of Finance, Board of Trustees of the GPF, the Board of Trustees of the Public Investment Corporation.
Zirk, how much in total have they squandered on these political-driven projects since the start?
In 2016, they made a report to the Parliament Standing Committee on Finance, known as SCOF. At that point of time, they have already, as from 2009, invested 44 billion rand of pension funds. And they had, as I indicated, a 44 failure rate of that. If you analyze, as from 2015 until today, the total money written off as impairments. That is about 52 billion rand. At our calculation, this is that 31 billion rand was Isibaya investments and which was lost. Now, if you invest any money in any private investment company, a 1% failure rate can be acceptable. That is the industry norm. What they are writing off here are 3%. And if you confront them with that, they say, why are you concerned? It is only 2%. It is only 3%. That 3% is 33 billion rand. 33,000 million rand. That, in my mind, is big money.
Yeah. You know, when you start turning over these rocks and you see how incompetent cadres have been plundering this nation of ours, you've just got to shake your head. Here's something that Zirkos and others in these are pensioners. They depend on the state pension fund. And they are analyzing, as they must, as they should, the investments of the state pension fund. And he points out that billions and billions of rands is being wasted in bad investments, usually politically motivated. What does that say in South Africa speak? Well, if you've got a pal in the government, they'll twist some arms and you will get money. It's not acceptable, guys. We've just done this too much now. It's now into the future. South Africa needs to clean up its act. We know that from all issues. And my goodness, you can't steal. And that's what's happening from the pensioners. Ernst von Sail of AfriForum has become something of a celebrity in the United States. This after he put together a documentary on the struggles of Afrikaners that, went into the United States. Initially, through YouTube, through this channel, it was well watched, but then suddenly it went nuclear. He tells us the story.
The central question comes from the fact that ever since February, when Donald Trump took aim at South Africa, there's been a lot of debates online, and in the mainstream media, a lot of panel discussions, a lot of interviews, a lot of discourse. But at the end of the day, I just realized that everyone is scared about touching this question, this almost nuclear or this radioactive question. Is Trump actually right about South Africa? Everyone's talking around this issue. And so we made a documentary where we talked to experts to try and answer that question, but not to get to a point at the end of the documentary where we tell our audience, well, now you know what you think of the situation, but rather we're going to present you with all the facts and you can decide for yourself at the end. And we looked specifically at race laws in South Africa, and we looked at the Expropriation Act, and we looked at farm murders in Kiel de Boer. And we made that documentary, we published it, it did very well on YouTube. It got 150,000 views on YouTube, which was fantastic. I mean, if it was just that, if that was the end of the story, I would have hailed it as a major success. And then a few weeks later, I thought, well, a lot of people on X are asking me to share this documentary on X as well. And I thought, well, on YouTube, it seems to have reached a saturation point. The YouTube audience have all seemed to have seen it. Its views aren't growing as fast anymore. Let's put it on another platform. Let's see how it does. And we put it on X, and it did very well up until the point where my phone just exploded with notifications. I mean, I was just getting lunch, and my phone looked like it was glitching. It looked like it was going to explode, just seeing at the amount of notifications and messages I was receiving. And then I went to my X account and I saw, Elon Musk just shared the documentary on his platform to his millions and millions of followers. And today, to get back to your initial question, today that documentary stands at almost 45 million views. That's almost the population of South Africa. The 200,000, about 200,000 views that I was extremely happy with on the YouTube version of the documentary, just it just is completely blown out of the water. I don't even know how to react to 45 million views, but that's where it stands at the moment. Major victory for the truth about South Africa. And as I said, with this documentary, we actually went, I'm so glad it's this documentary that went viral, because we went meticulously out of our way to ensure that every claim made in that documentary is backed up either by a footnote at the bottom of the screen that says, here's that information source, or the speaker or interviewee actually references where that information is from. So every single claim in the documentary is backed up by a source on where you can find that information. Because as I always say, don't just believe what I say or what AfriForum says. Research what we say and what I say. Go look it up. If I say something that doesn't sound right to you, go check. Maybe I'm wrong. And I'm open to being pointed out, that people point out that I'm wrong. But you can't just shout misinformation. You actually have to give counter evidence. And up until this point, there's been no refutation of the claims in that documentary, just a lot of shouting from some media figures about misinformation, disinformation, whatever the new buzzword is. You know the drill.
Infant sale. I can relate to that. That's what we're about at BizNews. Okay, we're never going to get it 100% right 100% of the time. But our philosophy is when we are wrong, we promptly admit it. So if there's stuff that you see on BizNews, if there is information that you see on this program where you say we got it wrong, well, show us and we'll fix it and we'll correct it. And that is the difference between what Ernst von Sail is talking about now and what his critics appear to be saying. If there is something that they have done incorrectly, he says, show us and we will then have a look at our references and put the one against the other. And that's really what society is about. That's what life is about. That's what science is about. That's what progress is about. If something is wrong, question it, point it out, and let's move on. Don't just accept as fact somebody or something that you've been told to believe. Because we were all made with these incredible brains that have the ability to become divine. Okay, that's my little spiel for the day. On to Ian Cameron now. He's a guy who Chris Dane spoke with yesterday, best known for when he was in Action Society, a activist. The Democratic Alliance pulled him into the parliamentary operations. He very rapidly rose through the ranks there and is now the chairman of the committee, the Parliamentary Committee on Police. And so Chris spoke to him about farm murders to try and get some rational perspective on it. And the feedback that we got from Ian was that it's not quite as simple as some people might have it. Here's Ian Cameron.
Sure. So first of all, I must start by saying that I think farm attacks and farm murders are oversimplified very often. It very often happens, and I read opinions where people say it's purely one thing, let's say political, or they say it's purely another, let's say robbery or robbery aggravating. And you know, it's just simply not that simple. Farm attacks should be considered a very complex crime category. And there are many reasons for that. And I'm going to share that with you. Now, as context, I worked with farm attacks for close to a decade. I think, all in all, somehow had contact either on the scene with the victims, suspects, etc., with close to 300 specific incidents, my team and I at that stage. So I've seen a very broad range of farm attacks, the cruelty, how those scenes compare to urban scenes, and I'm going to share that with you as well. I think to start with, it's important to understand that South Africa has different kinds of demographic structures or you know, demographic layouts across the country, which is logical from in terms of cultural differences. But there's an important part that one must consider to start with, and that is the role that certain illegal foreigners might sometimes play. You know, if you look at attacks on the eastern side of the Free State, you would often see that they are people that come from Lesotho. If you look at parts of northern KZN, for example, they may be from Swaziland or Eswatini. You might in, I always use the example of Hartbeespoort Dam or Brits. You'll very often see Mozambicans and Zimbabweans. In parts of Mpumalanga, you might only see Mozambicans. And then sometimes you've got groups that are a blend of a whole different bunch of people, whether they are from Namibia and the Western Cape. Very, very often we see that suspects are from Namibia originally. And then you've got incidents, we use KZN and Gauteng as an example, in rural areas where the entire group is South African. So it's simply not as simple as saying that it's one group versus another, because it's more complex than that. The last two parts, Chris, about what makes a farm attack unique, apart from the disproportionate violence, is one, it's the only one, that the only violent crime in South Africa that is politically encouraged, where certain people, and you know who I'm talking about, can continue to sing songs that encourage killing. They can sugarcoat it all they like. It is hate speech and it is incitement of violence. And whoever doesn't see that, including some of our courts, I'm extremely concerned about the compass used to determine that it is just purely freedom of speech. It cannot be that in a democratic country where we're aiming for a democratic, sustainable future, that is allowed. So that's the first part. The last one then is the fact that it's often encouraged or cheered on social media. Very often you would read on social media about a farm attack or a farm murder and it'd be something horrific. And then you read the comments and you see how people laugh about it, how people say, well done. And they encourage these horrific, horrific things. What saddens me sometimes is that often before, I never ever, and I have never mentioned race when telling or sharing information about a farm attack. The assumption is very often made that because I said it's a farm attack, that it's a white victim, and then it gets cheered on. And they would specifically say, yeah, you white this and that. As soon as I say, but hang on, it wasn't a white person, then suddenly it goes quiet. There's this awkward silence. And it shouldn't be that way. It is absolutely tragic that anyone should be faced with this type of violence.
It shouldn't be that way, Ian Cameron. It shouldn't be that way, South Africa. When you travel abroad, race is just not an issue in 99% of the world. Go to England, go and have a look there, and you'll see that it's what comes out of your mouth that defines you. You're either English because you've got an English accent, or you're not because you've got a South African accent. It doesn't matter what the color of your skin is, and yet here in South Africa, this obsession that is continuously fueled by politicians, and we'll see more of that coming later in the program in the body language segment, is just, well, it's time to move beyond it. I'm sure everyone will agree to that. A little bit of investment information now, and starting off with a new listing. Well, not a new listing, but a new type of listing on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. A while back, Anglo American was attacked for a takeover bid by BHP Billiton. The Anglo American executives and board of directors felt that BHP Billiton was offering too little, so they got shareholders to support their alternative view, which was unbundling some of the assets in the company and sprucing up the organization, restructuring to a large degree to unlock shareholder value. Well, the shareholders believed them. They saw off BHP Billiton. And the first concrete result of that is today on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, where Anglo American has unbundled its stocks, its holding rather, in Anglo Platinum. Anglo Platinum's taken the opportunity of its new independence to change its name, and it's now called Valterra Platinum. And the chief executive, Craig Miller, spoke to our partners at Bloomberg on what is the first day of the rest of the life of this new look company.
You said in the statement, the company, this new company will assist in building the company's capital markets profile. Talk to us about what this strategy means, or what the strategy looks like moving forward.
Thanks very much and good morning. The strategy is really predicated on three fundamental things. Operational excellence, really creating sustainable shareholder returns, and really thinking through the fundamentals for the PGM market and how we can create future demand for the products that we mine. And so when I think about operational excellence, that really has been focused around really creating value from the assets that we have within the portfolio. So both our assets here in South Africa and then also in Zimbabwe, so Mogalakwena, Amandelbult, Mototolo and Unki, and really then also the integrated value chain that we have. So we go from mine all the way through to refining, and we believe that given the resource endowment that we have, that we can extract further value from that. And then as a company going forward, we are really focused around value over volume. So really creating that value from the assets and then being incredibly disciplined in our capital allocation, and therefore thinking through superior shareholder returns as we embark on our new journey as Valterra Platinum.
What are you looking to do in terms of value? Like, where are you investing in to ensure that you get the most value within this new spinoff?
Yes, so as I said, we've got an incredible endowment in multi-decade life assets in the PGM sector. The assets that we have are really world-class, and therefore our opportunity is to extract the value from our existing asset base. And so we're focused around continuing our exploration at Mogalakwena and potentially going underground at our Mogalakwena mine, which has a life in excess of 80 years. We're also focused around extending the life of the mine at our Mototolo operation on the eastern limb in South Africa, and then also how we extract further value from debottlenecking and optimizing our processing assets. And we're looking to repurpose one of our smelters in order to continue to treat material that we have. And that's where our key focus is, in addition to not only coming back to that operational excellence and ensuring that all our assets operate sustainably in the lower half of the cost curve, and then continuing to generate positive cash margins even at the low point in the price cycle.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
Now, there's a point of view that you might be following here, which is when you bet on human initiative, on human capital, it's a good time to be investing in companies that are newly independent. Anglo American was the controlling shareholder of Anglo Platinum forever. It is no longer. It's pared down its stake to a, well, as you saw from the slide early on, to under 20%. But that means that Anglo Platinum and its management now make the decisions. It's similar to what happened at Thungela Coal, and that was one of the best performers after its spin-off from the Anglo-American operation a couple of years back. Maybe there's a tip for us there. Emerging market currencies are likely to see further improvement into the future, and that includes the South African rand. Our partners at the Financial Times of London explain why in this morning's in an excerpt this morning on the FT News briefing program.
Asian currencies seem to be a winner in the global trade war. The Korean won, Japanese yen, and Taiwan dollar have all rallied in the past few weeks. Investors are betting that currency deals will be part of trade negotiations for the U.S. Here to explain is the FT's William Sandlett. Hey, William.
Hi, Mark.
William, tell me a little bit about what investors are betting on that's causing these currencies to jump in value.
So it seems to be that there are expectations that as these trade negotiations unfold with the U.S., one of the conditions will be less intervention from central banks into forex markets. We saw a pattern where whenever, let's say, Korea or Japan mentioned that they had been discussing exchange rates with the U.S., their currencies would rally. This is part of a kind of structural feature of the U.S. and Asian exporters. A lot of these countries have huge FX reserves that they export a huge amount to the U.S., and a lot of those assets now are moving back to their home countries, either in the form of currency hedging or exporters repatriating assets. So there's this wave of U.S. dollars being converted back into home countries' currencies. And then there seems to be a sense that central banks in the region are committed to allowing this appreciation to happen as part of trade negotiations.
And why do investors think that'll happen, William? What have we actually seen so far?
Well, what we've seen is these currencies appreciating in response to announcements that Korean officials or Japanese officials have been discussing exchange rates with their U.S. counterparts. strategists, analysts, and investors are seeing this as a sign that the market is sort of pricing in this possibility of these negotiations. And on top of that, of course, there are these this structural economic reality that a lot of these countries do have enormous US dollar reserves. And it seems as though there's a pattern of repatriation and a rotation out of US assets. In general, when the US dollar weakens, it's very good for emerging markets, for their equities in particular. So it will make imports into these countries more affordable. It'll help the consumption in these domestic economies. So there are knock-on effects for the region that are, you know, significant for investors and that they're watching if this trend continues.
That's the FT's William Sandland. Thanks, William.
Thank you.
Jesus Enrique Rosas is known as the body language guy, and clearly many people who are members of the BizNews community follow this gent. He had a look at the Oval Office Smackdown and the body language that came out of it. You can watch the full video on YouTube on his channel, as well as on the BizNews TV channel. You can see all of the videos from the program today. But let's have a little taster of what this body language expert thought of Cyril Ramaphosa's performance last week.
We were taught by Nelson Mandela that whenever there are problems, people need to sit down around a table.
Notice what Trump is about to
talk about. And this is precisely what we would also like to talk about, including, of course, trade matters, investment matters. So the issues that concern you as the United States.
These are all deaths. He just gives him the bunch of papers. He doesn't say anything. He just gives him that. This is cinema. This is absolute cinema. This has always been. This Oval Office encounters keep getting better and better. And this.
That scene of, you see how many crosses they have. Those crosses, that's a dead person in every one of them. And those trucks or cars are paying their respects to all of those dead people on a Sunday morning.
Notice that Trump is talking about people paying their respects to the dead. And notice the attitude of Ramaphosa when Trump says that.
Paying their respects to all of those dead people on a Sunday morning.
It's like he is upset of what he's saying. Of all the things that he could be upset, he's upset about people paying their respect to the dead. You notice from his body language that this guy is... This guy is not a good person.
I'd like my minister.
This is my favorite part. This is my favorite part. I'd like my minister
of agriculture, who is white, who comes from an opposition party to mine, who's joined my government at my invitation to address this very issue, including the question that you've just raised.
Remember that he mentioned that since he has a white minister of agriculture, that nothing is happening to whites in the country. Can you imagine if the races were reversed? A white guy says, "Hey, I brought my black minister of agriculture, so nothing is happening to blacks in our country." It's like it's like the Chinese that they always make sure to have a blonde guy in the team, in business teams, so they have like, oh, we have a blonde guy. We can brag about having a blonde guy. This is like DEI in reverse. We have a white minister of agriculture. Yeah, this is DEI in reverse. Well, in fact, it's exactly the same as DEI, not exactly in reverse, but you get the idea, right? It's a stupid argument.
That's how the world sees us. 340,000 people have watched the full video of the body language guy. I'm Alec Hogg. Be back tomorrow with tomorrow's briefing. Until then, cheerio.